I would like to talk about the social shaping process, in your own words, that affects children from the point of view of gender socialization. How do social standards weigh on individuals through parents, relatives, institution, or the media?
Well, that's a deep question. And it had so many parts. I guess the answer I would give is that in terms of social influence or social shaping on adolescents, the principal power arises from peers. And it's through peer influence that distinctive adolescent cultures emerge, and you begin to see local normative scripts for all sorts of behavior, sexual behavior, academic behavior, and so on. The role of parents is interesting. Clearly, parents have enormous impacts on kids, but probably in ways that are much more subtle than they think. So, for example, parents who have meals with their kids have an enormous impact on them. Parents who have directed conversations with kids about sexual behavior, for example, have almost no impact on their kid. And that's principally because the way in which parents can structure and shape kids' orientations is through modeling a whole array of social behaviors, of which having conversations, sitting, discussing things, doing things is the currency that works. So parents who set out to influence their kids, ironically, probably have significantly less influence than parents who simply spend time with their kids. For kids and for parents, there's this idea that peer influence is always negative. At least in America, it's almost humorous that all parents think that their kids are at risk for the negative influence of other kids. But obviously, if there's a good kid and a bad kid in interaction with each other, such that the so-called bad kid can influence the good one, then it's naturally the case that influence could be bidirectional and the good kid could influence the negative kid. And in fact, parents don't think about that, but the biggest impacts on peers are on positive behavior. So peer influence is not uniformly positive, but it's demonstratively more positive than negative. And parents, I think, have a hard time seeing that. So those shaping processes are, I think, critical. The media, you read a lot of studies that show media effects on adolescent behavior. And there obviously are media effects. So there are pretty interesting studies that show when very aggressive anti-drug campaigns are initiated, and where there's saturation of the media on those drug campaigns, that the consequences is that kids will take more drugs. So there's clearly a media effect that's possible. But you know, this diverse effect of the media on shaping kids' risk behavior, sexual behavior, I think is pretty hard to locate. Schools are in America enormously important for those kids who feel attached to school. And attachment to school is a very fragile thing, and it's hard to figure out, you know, there's very little that schools can do to shape attachment. The dynamics of scheduling, the perversity of tracking all create energies within the school that are disaggregative and segregative, so that kids who are athletes don't hang around with other kids. And so schools are forced to live with those structures. So parents can figure out if kids are attached to school by their orientation, and they want to go to school, they feel like a part of that school. And if they do, then it's great. And if they don't, then parents can exert enormous influence simply by moving their kid. Of course, that's a social class that's a benefit of being upper class, is the capacity to get out of one setting and into another. But if parents can do anything for kids, it's to figure out, oh, they're in a bad setting. All you have to do is move them.
Okay. You studied the sexual networks that exist within the youth in a small Midwestern town that you dubbed Jefferson City. I was wondering, what are the cultural and sexual models according to which young people define themselves?
Yeah. So that's, of course, now a decade old, that study, because the first wave data for Jefferson arose out of interviews in the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health that were conducted in 94. That's 94 and 95 data. So those kids are now in their mid-20s. Those kids, then, you know, 15 to 18 in high school, have the most phenomenally normative orientation to relationships than you could imagine. If you give them, as we did, cards that ask them to order in the ideal relationship, like what in the ideal would you like to have happen next year? The order starts off with going out with a group, meeting the parents, maybe holding hands, exchanging presents, kissing, then another effective demonstration, saying I love you, getting an I love you back, touching underneath the clothes. So it's this really ordered progression to sexual behavior. And it's incredible, and it's uniform. It's not just that school, it's pretty much uniform across the culture. Obviously there's some kids who have a different model. You know, the boys have a slight preference to have physical encounters before social encounters. Girls would like to have effective communication before sex, but these are really tiny marginal differences. So the incredible thing about American kids, and actually it's something I think that people really don't get, you know, but the incredible thing about American kids is how overwhelmingly normative they are. So that's the first thing. The second thing is American kids are overwhelmingly so-called good kids. 95% of them engage in, try hard in school, would like to go to college, would prefer to do well, want to take care of themselves, prefer not to be overweight, would like to exercise more. So they have all sorts of normative, positive ambitions and goals. And of course, they engage also in, you know, risk behavior. That's what being a kid is. So the kids' orientation to kind of relationships is just surprisingly conservative. Their orientation to sex is different than our orientation to sex. By our, I mean someone in my generation at 50. First, oral sex lies in a liminal category, somewhere between sex and just petting. And I think that wasn't true for our generation. Secondly, anal sex, which really was something that only Southern girls did in a kind of sick strategy to preserve their technical virginity. Anal sex is a more diffused behavior than you might anticipate. So, you know, a quarter of kids will have experimented with it. So there's differences, and there's more interesting exploration. But in general, the really striking thing is it's incredible conservative progression to a full-blown relationship. What's also going on is, you know, adolescent relationships are short. They're significantly shorter for boys than they are for girls. So if you have couples, and if you have data from both couples, the boy's relationship with the same girl is 4 months shorter than the girl's relationship. So boys are simpler creatures in the sense that they don't even know they're in a relationship for many months, whereas the girl already knows it. But they're on average 11 months long. So, you know, it's about a semester, about a year. They're sporadic in the sense that there's in and out of engagement in them, and they don't have the same names that we used to give to them. So this kind of shortness and sporadicity and the lack of naming, like going steady, makes adults uncomfortable around them. I think kids do a pretty good job of practicing intimacy. They have very few models. And again, it goes back to a comment I made about parents, is that most parents really don't quite, we don't really have a strategy for modeling intimacy. We don't teach intimacy. We don't teach kids in sex ed what it means to be intimate. So there's a shyness of this, of the fundamental reason to be in a relationship. There's a, this culture is absolutely silent on.
Okay. In recent years, shootings have occurred in several American high schools and campuses. And do you think that the young murderers were driven by a certain ideal of virility?
No.
So how would you explain such slaughters?
Well, on any given day in an American school, there are guns all over the place because there are guns all over the society. There's a million kids. I think we calculated once there's a million kids, and every day there's like 1 million kids exposed to a gun in school. So just probabilistically, you know, there are guns all around. I don't think it's virility. I think it's you know, this is so far, I haven't done any research on this. The usual stories are the so-called dark side of social capital. There's a small intact community. The kids are known to be disturbed. They're the kids who are, you know, cutting worms in half, you know, shooting little birds and.
But actually, I was thinking of becoming a Nazi.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
How do you become a murderer?
Yeah.
In this,
I think the becoming a Nazi is about the elision of social relations, and yeah, this doesn't strike me as the same dynamic.
Okay.
I think these are just kids who have access to guns and are full of rage against themselves.
Okay.
It's also, you know, it's a pretty rare event. I know it. You know, it's obviously more common than in other countries, but we Americans are killing each other at a phenomenal rate with guns, and you know, I think if you're an angry kid and there's a lot of suicidal ideation that is permeating through all cultures, but it permeates through the adolescent culture. So you combine access to guns, suicidal ideation, and anger, and you could easily get inward-directed rage directed outwards.
Okay.
It's the same motive, I think, that leads people to throw themselves in front of a subway car to commit suicide, which, from an objective point of view, is just absurd. You know, but it's this combination of rage and and so destruction.
So your research is strongly related to public health, especially within the youth. How is the AIDS epidemic related to partnership patterns in a small Midwestern town?
Probably not. The other STD epidemics are related to those. AIDS is just, the probability of getting AIDS on unprotected sex is so low, 1 in 2,000, that you really need another kind of dynamic to go on.
So but other diseases.
But the chlamydia epidemic in the United States, the gonorrhea, syphilis, all the other STDs, herpes, HPV, are really strongly related. And it's complicated because the structure of adolescent networks, if we're right that they're spanning trees, that is, they don't have cores. If they have a core structure will give rise to endemic pools of infection. And so the traditional models would be that there's an endemic pool of infection, people reinfect each other. Somebody comes in, gets it, and it goes out a little bit. But the epidemic is sustained by the pool. But in our idea that what you have are long chains of very thin connections, what you have is then the capacity for extremely rapid widespread transmission of an STD. But it's very fragile because at any moment you could get a cut in the lines. And actually the structure that we observe is great for public health. You know, if you actually could just get kids to use condoms more often, you could really make a fundamental difference. And there's another interesting implication, which is given that every kid is in one of these chains, then the characteristics of individuals are not really predictive about their STD acquisition risk. And that means that you're targeting, you have to have a much different targeting strategy for influencing kids. So the public health implications are pretty important.
Okay. Do you think that virginity pledges as a personal and public refusal of sexuality are a way to extend the pledger's childhood? So, do you think that anorexia is comparable to virginity pledges with respect to creating a new identity or becoming visible?
No, that's a sweet question. On the first part, no, I don't think they're about extending a kid's childhood. First of all, kids who take pledges, they're thinking about sex. The 13-year-old boy who's playing with guns in the backyard is not thinking about sex. He is not going to take a pledge. So already there's selection on the transition to adulthood. So pledges are really effective for kids who can't negotiate the gray zones of intimacy. If they don't know how to say, no, not now, but I like you, you know, that's a subtle communicative device. So it's easy to say, I pledged. And so, you know, pledges are really effective for kids who are less able to negotiate intimacy. And as a consequence, pledges are attractive for kids with slightly lower IQ than kids who have higher IQ. But it's not about elongating childhood. It's about, for those kids for whom it's beneficial, it's really about a language to have a discourse about intimacy, and it works for them. For those kids who are pledging because their parents want them to pledge, it's about the parents' desire to extend the child's childhood, and perhaps their own. And in that regard, I think it has very little to do with anorexia, which anorexia is the girl's desire to express control over at least some area of her world, or if it's a boy, their world, around which they have almost no control because they're buffeted by powers that seem alien to them. And so anorexia seems to me, and I'm not really an expert on it, but it seems to be a response to, and it's an attempt to gain control over what's impossible to nail down in their life. And weight is one thing that kids can control if they put their will to it. Both pledging and anorexia are probably unhealthy in the long run. Pledging is unhealthy because it doesn't really teach the importance of why we're human, so it doesn't get you anywhere emotionally. And for most kids who pledge, it puts them at risk to get an STD subsequently.
Okay. You've been conducting a general survey on autism and autistic children. What does it consist in, and what are your goals?
Yeah, I've totally shifted research areas. I'm at the moment, I'm really interested in trying to understand what causes the increased prevalence of autism. So in the United States, but also France, there's been a phenomenal increase in the incidence of autism. And generally, you know, there are three or four theories. One is that it's a diagnostic dynamic, that all you're observing is diagnostic change or diagnostic substitution. It's one idea. Another idea is that that there really is an environmental toxin that's dangerous and producing developmental disorders in kids. The third idea is you get some form of genetic expression in the context of the environmental change. And a fourth idea is that there are technologies of reproduction and technologies of obstetric practice that are producing, on the one hand, more children who are the result of assisted reproductive therapies of some sort, or on the other hand, they're just kids who are surviving longer because of capacity to live. And to try to disentangle all of these factors as causes of the epidemic. That's pretty much what we're doing at the moment. What the long-term interest is to try to understand the social dynamic of contagion for health outcomes that are non-contagious. And so there is autism in the world, and there are kids who are really autistic, and it's clearly increased. But there's also clearly a dynamic by which parents come to understand that their children have autism through a clinical intervention, by which they communicate that to others, and there's a diffusion of the capacity to be ascertained as autistic, and that's true for ADD and ADHD, and probably the next outcome will be bipolar. disorder. So I'm interested in modeling and understanding that, that contagion dynamic for things that aren't contagious.
Okay. And I have been struck by how present the issue of autism is in the U.S. compared mm-hmm. to France.
Yeah.
How different are Europe and the U.S. In terms of how public institutions take care of autistic children?
I don't know the answer to that question. I know that in the United States there's a vast set of resources that are deployable to children with autism in terms of schooling, and that that the parents' organizations have been very, very powerful in mobilizing collective resources to take care of those their children.
And how about the institutions?
The institutions.
How do they take care of the children?
Yeah. Well, the general. Again, I'm really so far in this project. I focused mainly on epidemiology, and so the treatment side, I haven't really followed beyond what I think lay people would know, which is that it's really clear that, that autism is, first of all, it's hugely variant. So for those children with autism who are not also comorbid with mental retardation, it's a disorder that, that always reveals pockets of ability. So the trick of treatment is to capture, harness, and work with those pockets of ability. And that typically is easier the earlier it is that intervention comes. The other thing I think is true for autism that is not comorbid with mental retardation is that it's an attention disorder. Fundamentally, it's related to an attention disorder. That is, it's a disorder that at least makes it hard for kids to attend if there's a lot of background stuff. And so one-on-one interventions are effective in helping kids with autism reach their potential. But I haven't got to that side of the problem yet.
So, now about public policies. Could you explain to us what the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health is, and what kind of information does this program provide, mm-hmm. and how does it help you in your research?
Well, the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, or Ad Health, is a very, very large federally funded study started off of kids age 12 to 18, or in grades 7 to 12, in 1993, who have now been followed over four waves. And the beauty of that study was that most studies up until that point were designed to think about individuals in some abstract context, and they would interview one or two or a few individuals in a particular setting and then try to make inference to kids as a whole. And Ad Health adopted a completely different design, which was essentially to make it possible to that all descriptions of contexts, the relevant context in which kids live, their family, their peers, their schools, their neighborhoods, their work settings, that there were multiple voices on those contexts, multiple points of view from which we could induce description. And so there's incredibly rich data on peers. We have data from over 100,000 kids on the social structure of over 140 schools. There's incredible data on family composition. So we have a complete genetic design where we have thousands of twin pairs, thousands of full sibling pairs, thousands of half sibling pairs, and kids who live in the same household or are unrelated to each other. So from its conception, it was a sociological study. That is, the sociological elements that make people were embedded into the design. It was completely radical from that point of view. And it's been very important in our thinking. It's enabled sort of scientists to measure context in meaningful ways. I think it's transformed the way people think about health for kids. Now that the waves 3 and 4 are following these 20,000 respondents into young adulthood, they're now married, they have kids of their own, and it's going to be quite a remarkable resource in the future. It has a whole bunch of, we've collected a lot of markers, biomarkers. First, a whole series of STD biomarkers, and then subsequently DNA. So it's an incredible resource for social science.
At the end of your articles, you provide advice for policymakers. This might sound surprising to European sociologists. Some of them do try to advise policymakers, but not directly through their academic publications. Could you tell us if your research holds sway over public policies?
Yeah.
And if yes, how?
No. I think that our research on the pledge effect, showing that the pledging worked for some kids at some times, but for most kids didn't work at most times, and that subsequently that taking virginity pledges didn't reduce the risk of STDs, had the effect of mobilizing the right-wing policy machinery to try to develop counter-arguments to those facts empirically. And in the long run, it will have an effect when we have a government that pays attention to data. Under the current political climate, under the Bush administration, there's just been a widespread anti-scientific culture that has pervaded all of the policy domains. They make up data when it's convenient for them. They distort data when it's convenient for them. And our work has no impact whatsoever, except that it bothers the right wing.
And how it gets under
their craw. For example, we wrote in the second pledge paper that that kids who take virginity pledges, virgins who take virginity pledges, compared to virgins who didn't take virginity pledges, are more likely to have anal or oral sex, and that's true. It just bugged them. It grossed them out, and it got under their skin, and it should have gotten under their skin, because the beauty, again, of something I said earlier, that kids who take the pledge, they're thinking about sex. So virgins who are thinking about sex but can't have sex, you know, they're going to figure something out. Kids are super creative, but the right wing doesn't understand the plasticity and creativity of kids. That's why they are trying to crush them under the regime of enormous cultural restrictions. So it bugs them, and it engages them in things that they would otherwise not be engaged in, which I think is it's good. I think we're flies.
But do you feel the need for taking stand in such a debate or policies?
I got bored. And one of the reasons I left the sex field is I just got tired of the. I got tired of it, So I think, you know, when I do work and when we our work on autism, we're going to find the cause of autism, you know, and then we're going to have policy recommendations. Whether they'll be paid attention to, I don't know, that's another story. You know, as social scientists, we can always say we can make the recommendations, and then in this true Weberian way, you know, it's up to them to choose them. I'm not that optimistic. Most social science percolates through policy very, very slowly, often incorrectly. Even a so-called good social science takes a long time to get expression as policy.
Okay. In their book, Broken Promises, Norton Grubb and Marvin Lazazon contended that, quote, children are valued not for the individuals they are, but as instruments in achieving other goals, economic growth, the reduction of welfare costs, stable and fluid labor markets. The development of cost-benefit analysis has extended utilitarian logic to all public programs. End of quote. What do you think of this statement?
The second part of the statement, the development of cost-benefit analysis, its penetration, I think, is greater now than it was earlier to the detriment of public policy. So I think the classic example is Jenks. Jenks's work on schools. Like Jenks shows, like in 1967 or 1972, that resources to schools make no difference in terms of reducing cognitive inequality, right? And then he shows that school lunch programs make no difference to reducing cognitive inequality, but kids should still eat lunch. You know, lunch is good for you. So it has no benefit, but it's good, you know, it's good to have lunch. It's good to have recess. So I think that a lot of policy gets ratcheted into this side. The first part, I don't know. I mean, what's the claim that children are valued not for the individuals they are, but for the future goods they could provide? I doubt there's any empirical support for that statement. In agrarian societies in 1600 or 1200, that certainly wasn't true. I would think that's probably empirically false.
Okay. So do we have 5 minutes left, or
yes,
maybe you have to
you
rush?
Do.
I would like to ask you the very last question. It would be in our first part, Love and Sex. I was thinking of what you said about the conformity or conformism of American youth. I would like you to talk about the date. It is an American institution, and it doesn't exist in such shape or institutional shape in Europe and in this romantic country as France. So can you talk about this? How would you explain this institution, this vivid institution?
So that's a great question. What is a date? Yeah, all intellectuals will deny ever being on one. That's the first rule. And but a date is a moment in which you have an opposite sex couple who do something together in a very scripted manner that's out of the ordinary. So I think the trick to understanding the date is to understand the puritanical culture that is America. In Europe, boys and girls in high school interrelate with each other. You don't have this incredible sex segregation in friendship groups and in relation in just hanging around. But in America, you have significant sex segregation. And there's not a kind of organic set of opportunities for boys and girls to bump into each other, to hang out, to go to the beach, to go shopping together, to do things that they do in their everyday life. So the date is this liminal, abstracted moment from everyday life that couples otherwise sex segregated groups into some activity, and it's the falsity of the activity that makes the date real. So it's the date is the bringing together of the stranger, you know, the people on the other side to do something together that they wouldn't ordinarily do in their everyday life. Even the most mundane thing of like going to McDonald's, which they might do all the time by themselves, becomes sacred by virtue of its bringing together the two sexes. So that's why you don't have dates and we have dates. There are dates, I'm certain in other puritanical countries, if there could be self-organized, you know, coupling, they would have things like dates. So I think that's the trick of dates. And then there's the kind of interesting double dates, which are an attempt to embed the dating couple into everyday life a little bit more. So like group, you know, double dates are really good for that, because the other thing about adolescence, which I didn't say earlier, is that the relationships tend to privatize quickly, which I think is not true in Europe. So relationships move towards sex when they become privatized. So there is an elision of peers and an elision of family as the couple becomes intimate, because again, Americans, the parents in our culture privatizes intimacy. So the dynamics of intimacy are the rejection of the outside, which also creates the danger for the intimate partnership. Obviously, you know, privatized relationships are subject to control struggles within the relationship, to abuse, in ways that collectivized relationships that are embedded in everyday life aren't.
But so it doesn't mean it always ends with sex.
No.
So how come?
Yeah. Well, lots of kids don't want to have sex. One, lots of kids don't know how to have sex. They might want to have sex, but they have no idea how to get there. And the most interesting thing about partnership formation in the United States is that sex tends to be a predatory activity. Sexually experienced boys will prey on sexually inexperienced girls, but the beauty is that sexually experienced girls prey on sexually inexperienced boys. And that preying is really like just learning how to smoke pot. I mean, you have to do it with somebody, otherwise you don't get stoned. So they have, you have to know somebody who knows how to do it. It's complicated to get there. And I think that's the, that's why there's that asymmetry. As for the date, it's really just that we're so conservative.